Tonight's story is somewhat unique and calls for a different kind of introduction.
Who's gone off? Today we are canceling the apocalypse!
Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
And this is?
Lilu Dallas Multipass.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Houston, we have a problem.
Have you tried turning it off and on again?
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Now, where was I? Welcome to another episode of Nostalgia Busters. This is our series where we are going to be looking at a comedy film from the past, typically the 80s through to the unfortunately named noughties, and ask the question, does this still hold up and could it get made today? And my guest today is Jason Soto from Rabbit Hole Podcast and rabbitholepodcast.com, of which we are now a member. So, thank you very much for having us and welcome on board.
Hey, thank you so much for, having me back. I think I was on before.
Yeah, question mark. We've had too many of these episodes to know for sure.
But I'm happy to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, no problem at all. I'm really excited to get a bunch of people from the network to come on, and got a couple of other episodes lined up, which will be coming out in due time. Thanks for coming on as the first person from our new network. I believe you were the one that actually suggested the film we're doing today, which is High Fidelity. So my first question to you is, why did you pick High Fidelity?
Yeah, so I've been like a fan of this movie for a while. And like the really kind of odd thing about it, to me, I don't know, maybe you may view it differently, but it's kind of a romantic comedy in a way. And I usually don't mess with romantic comedies. Like I'm not a rom-com guy. Like most of them I just can't stand. But something about this one kind of like appeals to me. It might be because it's mostly from the guy's point of view, and it's done in kind of a interesting way. Like the focus is like the guy's side of a breakup, and I think something about that's kind of clever. But I've been a fan of it since I first seen it. Making lists is like one of my favorite things to do. And you know, he makes lists constantly in the movie, so I kind of bonded with the main character a little bit. He seems like a nerd. Like he's a little bit nerdy. He's very obsessive, mostly with music, but we get glimpses of movies in there, and so I kind of like identify with him just a little bit. So I don't know. It was just something about this movie that I really enjoy, and I've always really wanted to kind of talk about it. But the problem was I have a podcast that's about 90s movies, and this is from the 2000s, from the year 2000. So I was like, well, that doesn't work, and I don't really have like, you know, another podcast that kind of would cover this kind of thing. And I was messing with the idea of doing one of those movie by minute podcasts that our friend Bubba Wheat is like a huge fan of.
Yeah.
With this movie, because I really wanted to do like a deep dive on it, but then I didn't really have the time to do that. And then you said, hey, I need a movie from the 2000s. Does anyone know anything? And I said, hey, I got a movie for you. And here we are.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but Bubba Wheat, great guy. He's been on a couple of times, and I've been on both his both Groundhog Day and Fight Club. Great idea. I absolutely could not do that. I do not have the time to do that. I have at the point of recording, 5-month-old son and an 8-year-old daughter. And there is no time.
Don't blame you.
Yeah. Ain't nobody in this house got time for that. So
indeed.
I'm glad that you picked this film, because I had seen this film exactly once before you picked it. And it was something that I saw I believe over a decade ago at this point, I believe I saw it when I was at university. I was doing film studies at university, and I think it was one of my course film viewings that we had to watch. And so I remember enjoying it, but I didn't remember much about the film other than the general plot. One of the most frustrating things about the way my memory works is that if it comes to film and TV and I watch something once, it just sticks in my head and I know, you know, I can go to a film that I saw once 20 years ago and I remember exactly how it ends. I remember all of the plot points. I may not remember the exact lines, but, you know, I just remember that stuff. So I cannot rewatch something without knowing how it ends and everything. But with this one, it was interesting because, again, I knew the general plot of the film. There were a couple of moments that I knew were going to happen before they happened. And then I knew the general gist of the end. But I realized as I was watching it that I actually didn't remember a lot of the individual set pieces of it. So this one was as close as I've ever come to rewatching for the first time for something like this. And I do wonder, and we'll kind of get into it a little bit later, but I do wonder if it's because the music that's in this film is not music that I had listened to previously when I first saw it, and not music that I really listened to afterwards either. So, like, I think I just didn't have that much of the connection that you clearly did with, like, the main character and that sort of stuff. So that's probably why it didn't stick in my head as much as it normally does. And I will say, you mentioned that you love making lists, and I toyed with the idea of not doing a cheesy top five list for this. However, I don't think it's possible to review this film in any way, shape, or form without doing some sort of top five lists. So I asked you to come up with your top five songs in film. And I told you to take that however you wanted to. So, you know, whether it was going to be songs from film soundtracks, songs used in film for specific effect, or however you wanted to take it, or even just your favorite songs that are in film. So, you know, I have no idea what your list is. You don't know what my list is. True. And I think what we should do is go, I'll go first, and then you go after me, and we'll do 5-5-4-4, and like that. I previously you did say that you had kind of ranked the songs.
I wrote them down like how I thought of them, so right. Really, like, it's not like my number one is like what I think is the best one. It was just like the last one that I thought of, but I put it at number one. So
gotcha. So, okay, if you want to take 10 seconds just to kind of revise the list to order it, feel free. You don't have to. I attempted to put it in order. There's a couple that really could alternate, but my number one is my number one, and you'll understand why when we actually get to it. So I will say my number five is a little bit of a cheat, but I do have one specific one. And number five for me, top five use of songs in film, is basically any song that Quentin Tarantino has shoved into any of his films, because he is fantastic at picking those. However, I have specifically written down Stuck in the Middle with You from Reservoir Dogs. A great bit of music to go with that scene. Fantastically done.
I 100% agree. I didn't even think of that. That's a good one. That is really good. Yeah, that was a great scene.
All right, and so how about you then? What did you have in your number five spot?
My number five is from the movie Almost Famous. It's the tiny dancer scene on the bus. It's effective because, like, in the scene, everybody is just mad at each other for, like, things that happened scenes prior, and they're just kind of all, like, annoyed, pissed off. I think they're hungover because it was after a party, and they're just all feeling down, depressed, or on a tour. And then somehow, I forget how, but the song Tiny Dancer starts playing on the bus. And it's like the song is like 6 minutes long, and you hear almost the whole song in the scene. And as the song is getting, ramping up to the 2 minute mark when it gets to the chorus, and they start belting out the chorus, hold me closer, tiny dancer. Everyone starts getting into it slowly, like they're all pissed off, but then they start getting into the song and it amps up and it amps up. And then by the end of it, they're all like happy and they're friends again. And it's just such a cool scene and such a cool song to have that. They had that too, so I had to put that on here.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Good choice. Good choice. So number four for me is a classic, and it would be Johnny Be Good by Chuck Berry, used in Back to the Future.
Yes.
Like such a great scene in general. Michael J. Fox not actually playing in the film, however, he did learn the chord so that he would
Oh.
appear to be playing correctly.
Okay.
And of course, the double punch of he's playing music that these people have absolutely never heard before in a way that
Yep.
they've never heard before. And of course, the lead guitarist in the band is actually Chuck Berry's cousin. So it's just a great
Yep.
little button on that scene
Yep.
there.
Yep.
Right. And how
Yeah.
about you?
My number four, when I saw it in theaters, I was surprised at, and it's from The Devil's Rejects. It's the use of Freebird in the last 12 minutes of the movie. If you don't know the song Freebird, it's by the band Lynyrd Skynyrd, and it's like an 11-minute song. And Rob Zombie uses the entire song at the end of the movie, where the main characters, they're like these horrible serial killers, and they went on a killing spree, and now they got betrayed, they got shot at, they're hurt and wounded, they're in a convertible, they're just trying to run from the law. The song starts, and it's the whole song, like it's literally the beginning note to the ending note of just them driving on a highway, and then they eventually come upon the cops. They have a shootout. It's this whole thing done to this song. I'm a fan of Freebird. It is one of my favorite songs. It's probably the most like generic, obvious pick for a favorite song, but I really dig it. I think it's a good song. And using this at this point in the movie to close out your movie, I thought was brilliant. And there could be some double meaning to Freebird. I'm as free as a bird. They're trying to escape, but then they come across the cops. There's that whole thing too. But I just think like it was like the perfect soundtrack for the last like 12 minutes of the movie. So there you go. Yeah, Freebird from Devil's Reject.
Okay. All right. Yes. Yeah. Another good choice. Well done. All
Thank you.
right. So my number three is, and I have not seen the sequel yet, so no spoilers if you have, but it would be the Deo song in Beetlejuice. Again, another fantastic piece of music slotted into this film that already weird. And then this is just like, we are going off the wall for the next 2 minutes. We're just gonna
Yep.
have these people possessed and singing this song that nobody who had, nobody who's sitting down to watch the film thinks about this song. I'd never even heard that song before when I first watched Beetlejuice. And then all of a sudden, it's just this craziness of this song being sung.
Yep.
And of course, it's now pretty much a staple of that film. Anyone that thinks of that film will ultimately think of that scene and think of that song. So,
Indeed.
yeah, I felt it had to go on this list.
Indeed. Yeah, that's a good one. I've not seen a sequel either, so I can't know.
Okay, good.
All right, my number three, it's actually it's it was a very it was a popular song. It came out and it charted and everything, but the use of it, unlike my last two picks, is like a 15-second lyric that was used, but I think it was used brilliantly. And it's from the movie Disturbing Behavior, which is largely like mostly forgotten. I don't like people don't ever talk about Disturbing Behavior anymore. But it was a late 90s horror movie. And I think Katie Holmes was in it. Yeah, Katie Holmes was in it, and some other like popular teens at the time were in it. but the song is Flagpole Sitta by Harvey Danger. And it's very convoluted to explain the scene, but there's they're uncovering a conspiracy that's happening within their high school, and they realize they're in danger. And so then they have to like escape this place that they're in. And there's a lyric in the song that goes, paranoia, paranoia, everyone's out to get me. And that part plays as they're trying to escape the place that they're in. I don't want to spoil it too much if anyone hasn't seen it. Right. But they're in a place and they're trying to escape. And that, like, they just play that part of the song. And then the musical part of it, the instrumental part. But then it's the only lyric that shows up. And it was like the perfect, I think, sting for the scene. And I'm just gonna say right now, go see Disturbing Behavior. I think it's largely underrated. People do not talk about it. So there you go.
Okay. I'll have to add it to the list. I don't believe I've even heard of that film before today.
That's just a shame. It is such a good movie.
Yeah. Now, given that I was born in 87 and grew up in England, quite possibly it's just something that, yeah.
No excuse.
Was never on TV. I don't know. Yeah, I'll have to check that one out.
Yeah, please do. It's amazing.
Okay. So my number two is one that was almost my number one until I thought of my number one, and it couldn't not be at the top there. So this is Don't Stop Me Now by Queen from Shaun of the Dead.
Damn it.
The second that started, and you've got, you know, the whole joke, like, David killed a queen. What? The jukebox.
Yes, yes.
And, like, perfectly timed. Like, the comedy there is brilliant. And it just, since that film came out, it is not possible to hear that song without thinking of that scene if you've seen the film. So, yeah, just anyone that hasn't seen Shaun of the Dead, stop this and go watch it now and then come back. Yes. But, you know,
yes.
But yeah, this film just has forever overridden that song in everyone's head. So yeah, no, that is my number two.
I agree. That is a great pick. Okay. My number two, actually you just kind of mentioned it. It's from Fight Club. It's, the Pixies, Where Is My Mind? Honestly, could not think of a better song to end the movie. Like Fight Club. Like the most, like, I think the most perfect end until my number one. I had a similar situation with you, and I was like, because my number one is also the final song to a movie. Okay. But Where Is My Mind by the Pixies, like, you know, considering what happens in Fight Club, I think everyone knows the twist of Fight Club right now.
Yeah.
Whoever doesn't, I don't know what's wrong with you. But it's about this guy and his imaginary friend who started Fight Club, and then they cause chaos across the city and they blow up buildings and all this stuff. And so, as you know, the song Where Is My Mind is playing, all these buildings are exploding, and it's just like, I don't know if that was David Fincher's idea or whose idea it was, but that was such a brilliant use of that song. So I have to give it up to Where Is My Mind by the Pixies from Fight Club.
Yeah, a fantastic button to that film. Absolutely. Good choice. Good choice. All right. Now, before I say my number one, I will say I did toy with trying to figure out a way of getting another song on the list, but I couldn't take any of the ones that I mentioned off the list. So I do have an honorable mention, which is Mad World from Donnie Darko. I was considering the song that plays when you first go into the school. That one.
Yeah.
We'll just say
I can't think what it's called right now.
Yeah. which is a great bit of music, but
yes.
Mad World at the end is a fantastic use of that song and my introduction to that song. It is in my, you know, my Spotify favorite song. So every now and again, it comes up, like, you know, it's a great song. But my number one is a song that anyone that knows me would be like, you know, why are you choosing this? But it is solely the way it is used in the film that puts it at number one, and it's Putting on the Ritz in Young Frankenstein.
All right, yeah, I dad brilliant. Brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, just like that entire scene is phenomenal. Young Frankenstein is my favorite Mel Brooks film. Not, I'm not necessarily saying it is the best, but it is my favorite. It's just such a great film. And that scene, again, something that ultimately comes out of nowhere and then just ends. Like it's
Yeah. No,
but that little bit of just putting on the Ritz is fantastic and made better by the fact that nobody knew that the guy playing the monster was gonna yell out on
Peter Boyle. Give it to Peter Boyle.
Yeah. But yeah, no, as soon as I saw that, I was like, that can't not be my
Yeah.
number one.
That's a good one. That I agree. That is a good one. All right. I don't know how popular this movie was, but I fucking love this movie. It's one of my top 10 favorite horror movies of all time. It is such a brilliant film. It's Behind the Mask, The Rise of
Rise of
Leslie
Leslie
Vern,
Vernon.
and it ends with the Talking Heads' Psycho Killer. And I think they play the whole song there. And this is effective for a lot of reasons. One, Psycho Killer, and it's about a killer. But then it's done over what you think is a static shot of the morgue. And you think Leslie Vernon is dead, and you just see his body on like the stretcher or whatever. And then it's, the song's just going, and it's Psycho Killer, I guess I could say. And then soon he starts rising from the table. He sits up very slowly, and the song is going on, and then he just slowly gets out and walks out of the morgue, and then the song ends, and then and I was like ecstatic about this because Talking Heads is one of my favorite bands. Slasher movies is one of my favorite genres. Horror movies is one of my favorite genres. This movie was such a brilliant movie, like seriously, like hands down. If anyone has not seen it and you're a fan of horror movies, you need to go see this now. It is such a beautiful love letter to slasher movies, and it's just so well done. And the last scene is just brilliant with Psycho Killer. Like that's brilliant use of that song right
Yeah, I mean, anyone that's listened to this podcast
there.
over the last, several years has heard me many times recommending Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon,
Yes.
because that's another one I actually saw it as part of my film studies course, and the fact that it's a mockumentary, and then at the like three quarters mark, it just switches into an actual horror
Horror
film,
movie, yeah.
and everything that was built up is used in such a clever way.
Yes.
I still maintain, because I used to have the DVD before I moved to America, I still maintain that one of the deleted scenes from that film should have been kept in the film. I don't know if you've seen any of the deleted
I'm trying to,
scenes.
I don't, I may have once, like when it was kind of newish. I don't remember right now.
So basically, and I may have mentioned this before on the podcast, but fuck it, I'm doing it again. It's they're talking to him, and they're in the woods, and he turns to the woman interviewing and says, "All right, here's what we're gonna do. I am going to stand right here. You're gonna be 2 steps in front of me, and you're gonna run from here to that tree, and I'm gonna walk, and I'm gonna reach that tree before you." And so everyone's just like, "No, it's not gonna work." And he's like, "No, I'll do. I'll bet you." Like, $100 that I'm gonna reach that tree before you. And they go, "Okay, all right." And so, they're lined up and they go, "Ready, go." She starts booking it and he books it after her. But every single time she turns around, he stops and starts walking. So she does the horror film of turned around, starts running, and he's booking after her. And then just before she gets to the tree, she trips and he just walked past her, taps the tree, and goes, "You're dead."
Yeah, okay, I think I remember that. Yeah, that is so clever.
Yeah, so, such clever. A great thing. Should have been in the film. I understand why they may have cut it, because there's one or two scenes that are sort of, again, sort of poking fun at the tropes that are in the horror film.
But, right.
Yeah, and I do wish they kept that one in.
Yeah.
And here's hoping that they do eventually make the sequel. There is still, like, all of the cast want to come, well, you know, the cast that can, so, want to come back and make the sequel, but it is kind of in limbo based on the last time I was looking into it.
I am going to mention this. God, this had easily been like 5-6 years ago. There was a Kickstarter from like the writer or the writers of the movie where they turned the script of the sequel into a comic book. And then if you backed the Kickstarter, you would get the issue. And so I backed it, but I only got like the first 3 issues of it. And I don't know if they had to stop for some reason or something happened, but I never got the last, like, I think they were supposed to have 6 issues total.
Oh, same.
But yeah, I only got the first 3. I don't know whatever came of that whole thing. Like, if that ever went to market, if you can find it on Amazon or eBay or whatever. But I got, there technically is a sequel in comic book form, and I got the first 3 issues of it. And it's an interesting premise. I'm just going to say it. I won't get into it right now. Obviously I won't, but, it was weird. So they could still make it into a movie. You're right. They're all still very much around and alive. And, I hope they do. Cause it was an interesting premise. I'm going to say that it was pretty interesting how they were doing it. So
yeah. Well, here's hoping.
Here's hoping.
However, all of that preamble is basically us now deciding to dive into High Fidelity and really try and review this without any sort of rose-tinted glasses. We want to actually give it an honest review of how well it holds up. So just getting the nuts and bolts out of the way, directed by Stephen Frears, a budget of $30 million and a worldwide box office of $47,126,295, of which just shy of $20 million of that was considered domestic, so US box office. And obviously you kind of gave a quick breakdown of how much you really like this film, but when was the first time you saw this? How old were you?
Oh, I was like 20 or 21. It was not too long. I think it went to theaters, and then I don't think it did particularly well. Like, it was okay. It did okay. You know, like, it was not, I don't think it was ever number one or anything, but I think it did okay. It was a John Cusack movie, and he was still a pretty big name around the 2000s. And then I think it went onto video like 6 months later, 8 months later, and that's when I watched it. I ended up renting it from these mysterious buildings that, we used to have back in the wee days called video stores.
Yeah.
It was like Netflix, but in a building. And I was able to rent a physical copy of it and take it home, and I watched it. And because I was very curious about it, because, the ads for it, like, they made it look like it was like a wacky a wacky comedy of like, oh, this is guy, he's unlucky in love, and there's Jack Black being goofy. Oh, and then it ends up being like a romantic comedy.
But
that was how I first saw it.
a lot of these films back then, they really had some interesting marketing ideas for some of these films. Obviously this film, they clearly were like, we know it's a romantic comedy, but we also know that guys are actually going to want to see it, because that there's things in it that we know guys will want to see, that we can't necessarily market it as a romantic comedy, because at this point in time, you don't market romantic comedies to guys. That's not something that happens.
Right, exactly.
But it does become, let's put all of the wackiest moments in. Let's put several of the Jack Black moments in, because that's, he's the most bombastic character in the film. And that's actually saying something with some of these characters in the film. But it definitely seems like they were trying to scam people entity in the film.
I believe so too.
But I can understand why they did it. And for the time, it would have been the best way to get their target audience to see the film. So
yeah. And that was why I wanted to see it, because, you know, it was marketed as a comedy. But like the odd thing was I ended up still liking it. Like I watched it and it's like, oh, this is a rom-com, but something about it was like appealing to me. I was getting actually into the story, into what was happening. And I think it was just the presentation, and I'm sure we're going to dive into that, but I think it's how they presented the movie. Because if it was like a typical standard rom-com where it was just all only about like the breakup with him and the main girl, and then it was just focusing on that, I think I probably wouldn't like it as much. But the fact that it presents all of his previous girlfriends, and we get all the stories, and we get all these interludes and all this stuff, and his interactions with all the characters, I think that's what makes the movie for me.
Yep. No, I'd say the interplay of all of the characters is very well done. That there's, with maybe one or two exceptions, there's not too many characters that are interacting with other characters, and you're just like, okay, move on. Like, we, come on now. Let's keep this going. I will say that if I were to sort of make some editing decisions today, I probably would cut one or two of the scenes where it is just them in the store talking to each other, because there are many of those.
Yeah.
And I feel like it could sort of just tighten the runtime a little bit if you remove one or two of those. I don't know which. Yeah, I can't tell you right now. This is the one that would go, but yeah, maybe slightly shorten them. Like, yeah, just kind of tighten it up a little bit. But that's just me kind of trying to nitpick with that.
Okay.
I will say for the most part, the ensemble of characters is very good. There's never really a point where you're getting too bored with the characters. Right. With the possible exception of the one character that is boring on purpose. Like he's just kind of a blank slate. I'm not really sure.
Well, yeah, I'm assuming you're talking about Dick. I'm assuming you're talking about him. Is that who you're talking about? See, I kind of like his character because there is a type of person that is like that. Like,
yeah.
He's very reserved. He's really shy. You could tell he has like a good heart and he means well, but he doesn't know how to express himself.
Yeah.
He's nervous all the time. And he's more so when Jack Black's character, Barry, is just around. And because those two are polar opposites of each other. And you could tell that Barry gets under his skin a lot. And so whenever he shows up, you even see it in the introductory scenes when Barry walks in, you see the look on Dick's face like, oh shit, here he comes. Mm-hmm. I like his character because there are people like that, and I think even he adds some stuff to the movie. He even adds, like, in a way he's like the anti, you know, Rob, who's the main character played by John Cusack, in that he's this very sweet guy who finds this girl and then he starts connecting with her, and this kind of makes, I think, what makes Rob realize, okay, you know, not to mean this in a mean way, but if he can find love, I should be able to find love too.
Yeah, no, and that's it. That, you know, in watching the film and like really thinking on it, and say, maybe I found it, yeah, you know, like slightly like difficult to watch it, because if I'm 100% honest, like that's what I was like growing up. So like that very meek and like kind of just uncomfortable being around other people, but
yeah,
you do it because you do like the people that's there, but you know,
yeah.
That That was me. That was very much me growing
That's
up.
fair. And I could be kind of like that too at times. Like I can, you know, if anyone listens to any of my other show, that may surprise you. But there are times where like I'm around people I just don't know, and so I'm very uncomfortable and I don't know what to do with myself. So I see myself a lot in him as well, where I'm just like, yeah. There's a scene in the movie where Rob and Jack Black's character Barry like are kind of fighting, and he's and Dick's like in the background. He's just like, hey, guys, stop, guys, stop. And like you can tell he's just trying to like help stop the fight happening because they're kind of, you know, them two are his friends, but he also is not like brave enough to like actually try to stop them fighting. And that's totally me. I can see myself doing that if like two of my friends just start having a fight and they're getting physical like that, and I'm just like, come on, guys, just stop. No, you know, break it up. Come on, you know. That would totally be me.
When you don't have a broom handy, so you can kind of at a distance to start
Yeah,
the fight.
exactly.
Absolutely. But I do think it would be interesting. Clearly, you're a big fan of the film, and you've really enjoyed it over the years. On rewatching it and trying to come at it with this lens of, all right, what about this film doesn't necessarily hold up today? What did you notice on this watch that maybe you either skipped over last time, or you weren't really paying attention to, or like you didn't really realize it, but now that as a culture and a society, we understand things a lot better now. Is there anything that you notice that you would class as maybe a little bit problematic?
That's the see that's the weird thing about this movie is so this is from the year 2000, and I really couldn't find anything problematic, 'cause the few things you probably could pull as an example, I think was used in its strength in the film. And to give an example, to anyone who's not seen the movie, it's largely about this guy who's recounting his past five relationships that meant something to him and that ended terribly. And so he's going through them one at a time to try to figure out where he's going wrong. And one of the girls was he was dating in co or no, high school. And they were like 16, and he lamented that every time that they were making out, she wouldn't let him, you know, even touch her boobs like on the outside or anything. Like all they could do was kiss, and they never had sex. She never let him, you know, do anything. And then we find out that she started dating this like other dude, this jock. And then down the road later, when he's talking to her as an adult. And he's like, so what was up with all that? And why did you eventually have sex with the one dude? And she basically says, well, he raped me. And that kind of put me off of having sex until I was college. And in her eyes, you're not supposed to have sex until you're in college. And so people can view that probably as problematic, but I think that's what's played to its strength in this movie. Because they don't harp on it too much. It's just like a one-time thing, and then she leaves the movie. And it's kind of a point to be like, you know, oh, maybe you should respect your girlfriend's wishes, and you know, she doesn't want to have sex, or she wants to wait until she's older, blah blah blah. And then, you know, you think she's becomes this big giant slut, but no, she was forced upon. So, you know, you could look at that as problematic, but I think that played. For you know that played to its strength. That was supposed to prove a point. So stuff like that, I even is like, oh, they did that for a reason. So that's just how I kind of view that.
I really was kind of surprised at the scene when they are connecting in the restaurant, and she does go into something that you really didn't get in comedy films or even just most films back then, where she is genuinely pointing out, just like, It technically wasn't rape because I didn't say no,
Right.
but it was expected. It was, all this stuff. And it was a very good resolution to that thing because, when you're watching it in the beginning and you see John Cusack playing his 16-year-old self I mean, it's a good thing that they didn't have John Cusack playing his, what would it have been? 8-year-old self? Like, I don't know who the actual age of when it's, it was Drake Bell, I think, as which that kind of threw me for a loop. As when he walks on screen, having recently seen the Quiet on Set documentary,
Oh, okay.
just kind of seeing him pop up fresh face. It's just like, oh, okay. Hi, Drake. how's it going? But yeah, like it's a good thing they didn't just have like, we'll just have Jim Cusack play this game. But yeah, no, it was interesting because when that scene is played at the beginning of the film, it almost seems like it's being played as you're supposed to empathize with Rob in this particular scene. It's like, God, it must have been so frustrating. How could she not have done that? And that really did leave a little bit of a bad taste in my mouth. It's like it. I feel like the film. I mean, again, the actual scene where they talk about it at the end, and you realize like the other perspective and how shitty that is. It's so well done and done better than a lot of other films, even now, really, out of that sort of stuff. But like that initial thing, it really does kind of feel like the film trying to have its cake and eat it too. It's being like, oh yeah, there's a bunch of people watching the film that are really going to empathize with Rob, and they may not, even after the scene where you get the other side, they may still go, yeah, but and not people that I personally would like to associate with, but that kind of thing where it's like I still wasn't 100% sure on it, but I do fully admit, as a character moment, like it's clear Rob is a shitty person. Like,
Yes. No,
he's
I
not.
agree with that. Yes, 100%. He is a pretty terrible person through the whole movie. And it's and I and again, I think that plays up to the strength of the film in that we're basically getting the point of view of a shitty man, and we're getting the shitty man's point of view of all these relationships. And I think this is what's how it speaks well about, he says, she said stuff, because we're getting everything filtered through him and how he views the world. And he even, like, during that part, he's like, oh yeah, I broke up with her. And we're like, yeah, you did, you idiot. And so we're getting everything from his point of view. And we don't ever really see other people. There's like one really kind of odd scene in the movie where we're in someone else's point of view. It's the lunch scene between the recent girlfriend and Joan Cusack, because that's supposed to be happening in real life. And that's the only time we ever kind of break away from Rob. And so I think it plays up well, because if you're him, that's how you're gonna view that situation. You're gonna think, oh, this girl, she was just an ice princess. She wouldn't let me feel her up. She wouldn't let me have sex. And then I broke up with her because I'm like, well, we're not doing it. And then the next thing you know, 3 days later, some other douchebag is having sex with her. And you don't know, that's what happened. So you're just like, well, fuck. So I think it plays well on that. And I admittedly, he is a piece of shit in the movie. He's just a terrible person all around. But that I think that plays up to the character. And I think this movie does a good job in presenting a terrible person's point of view on previous and current relationships.
It is very interesting, like watching the film and trying to think like, does this person deserve to get back with the girlfriend at the end? Like, it. And all the way through, it really was something I was trying to think of because, yes, he's somewhat growing in the film, like even going through this whole thing and like talking with some of his past loves and everything. And it was just like, okay, obviously the very first one he learns absolutely nothing, and that's kind of the fun part. He just immediately turns to Karen, just like, she married Karen.
Yeah.
Like, this is great. This has nothing to do with me. Like, taking all of the wrong lessons from what you're trying to do immediately. And again, that's exactly what a shitty person would do.
Yes, no, exactly.
So yeah, very, very well done with that. I haven't read the book that this film's based on.
I
do really want to, just because I want to see what's changed. Other than the location, I want to see if that, like, if the character in the book is as shitty as Rock is in the film. And I have a feeling it probably is, but maybe it hits differently. I don't know.
Well, I can answer that for you because I have read the book.
Okay.
So besides the setting, it's in the book, it's set in London. The character in the book is, yeah, it's pretty much the same. There's not a lot of differences between the book and the movie outside of like the setting.
Okay.
And a couple of like minor characterizations of the other characters. Dick is even more shy in the book, if you can believe that.
Okay.
He's really reserved in the book. And he's more obsessed with music than Rob is even. But Barry's in the book, he acts the same way. We get the whole thing about all the relationships. So he's basically kind of the same in the book. You're more in his head in the book, though, which is very interesting.
And that would make sense.
Yeah.
Thinking about it, because I could understand if you were more in his head in the film, you would get sick of it. I think there would be a point, given how shitty of a character he is, that there would be a point where you would grow tired of Rob.
You wouldn't
care about his kind of redemption at the end. But like, the quotation marks over that word redemption, because I will actually say, when it comes to the end, and obviously spoilers, we've already kind of touched on it, but he gets back together with his girlfriend at the end of the film. Mm-hmm. And this film was really interesting for me to rewatch, because yes, I knew where it was going and all that sort of stuff, but I spent the first half of the film really thinking about how much I didn't actually like Rob, as a character, didn't like him. And then round about the start of the third act, I stopped thinking that. And it wasn't necessarily that he immediately gets better. Like, he's not really better by that point, but the story itself just sucked me in enough that I'd stopped thinking about that. And then by the end of the film, I realized that like half an hour had gone by and I was just like watching the end of the film and just thinking like, these two actually do work together.
Yeah. It is weird. They are
a good couple. It's kind of odd.
Yeah.
Especially when we got to see more of more of Laura actually like being present in the relationship and helping him and stuff like that, and obviously I think that is a choice with the film as well, because previously we've only seen her at the end of a tether ending the relationship,
mm-hmm.
after he's not really done much and she's like just looking for something else. But now at the end of the film, when they're kind of getting back together, we're starting to see more of why they would have been together in the first place. So a very good choice there. Seeing them interact, it really does kind of trigger for you, just like, yeah, these people work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they just work together, even though they're somewhat dysfunctional a little bit, and that was almost all on Rob's shoulders. It was It was good. I enjoyed the ending to it. My question to you at this point actually is, which character in the film, other than Will, did you enjoy the most?
Oh, hands down, Barry.
Okay. All right.
Like, yeah, like he was so entertaining. Like he just walked in and he's just this loud, bombastic, and he's an asshole himself. Like,
Oh, yeah.
Dick, I don't know if Dick is supposed to be an asshole. He's just so quiet and meek, but like there's just different versions of assholes in this movie. And we even got Tim Robbins' asshole, which we didn't really touch on, but he's an asshole himself. But no, Barry is like a lovable asshole. Like you kind of like hating him because he just comes in and he's like making fun of everybody instantly. He puts in this tape and fucking Katrina and the Wave starts playing, and the fact that he's like a music snob and he loves Walking on Sunshine by Katrina and the Waves makes me laugh hysterically. There's just something really like charming about that. I don't know what it is. And then the way he's just dancing around her that song, and then all of his comedic stuff through the whole movie is just brilliant. His comedic timing of, when Rob says to Barry about the singer. He's like, oh, why'd you tell her about the record store? Because he's just, he's ashamed of it, I guess. And Barry's like, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know it was a secret. I didn't know we weren't trying to get customers. Like the way he just interacts with everybody, the way he ribs on Dick all the time, and just all this stuff through the whole movie. And because it's Jack Black and he is, he's a singer, he sings in a band in real life. He sings at the end of the movie and it's really good. Like
Yeah.
he's a really, he sings Let's Get It On by Marvin Gaye really well. And I actually like that. I like that version of it. I like that version of that song. So yeah, hands down, it's got to go to Barry.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely see that, and it is kind of interesting because the second he walked in, my immediate thought was, oh, look, it's Jack Black from any film Jack Black was in at this point in time, because he very much was typecast as
Like a
the,
loud, goofy guy.
yeah, the loud, lovable, slightly annoying comedic character. And that's just because he has that energy. Like that was kind of what he was like back then, and people that were known for that never really got the straight roles until they'd been in the system a long time. So yeah, it is very interesting that I saw him and I was just like, I know exactly who this character is because I've seen a Jack Black film before. And yeah, very much was that. Actually, one of the films that immediately came to mind for this series when I came up with the idea was Shallow Hal, another Jack Black film that I was thinking, like, I understand the overall message of that film, but I feel like if you actually go and rewatch it, it's just an excuse to make a whole bunch of fat jokes.
It
And
basically was, yeah.
yeah, so I think that's going to be another a good one to do at a later date. But yeah, I was thinking, like, oh, this is Jack Black prior to School of Rock. Like this is before he kind of hit that stride of this is peak Jack Black in a comedy film. So yeah, he very much was loud and all over the place. But I still think that Ian is kind of my favorite character in the film,
Really?
just because, number one, Tim Robbins is just fantastic as a character. Like he came in and he literally said yes to the character if they would make a wig for him to wear. According to an interview that I saw from him like 5 years ago, he still has the wick. Like, and he will occasionally just put it on.
Oh,
like,
that's funny.
It was this film and another film that I can't remember off the top of my head, but both of them he said yes to if he could wear a wig, he has kept both of those wigs. But yeah, and I would argue that the single best comedic moment in the film is the bit when Rob is fantasizing about beating up Ian multiple times.
Yes, I love that part so much.
Because it breaks the rule of three because it's the rule of four. It happened four times.
Yeah.
And you never are sure that we're actually back to reality. Like the first time it happens, you don't know that reality is broken. And then the second it flipped back, you're like, oh, okay, that was in his head. Oh, okay. And then it just keeps happening. And then he just walks out.
Can I ask you which one of the four is like your favorite? Because I actually got a favorite.
I'm like, off the top of my head, I think it's the one where they end up, like one of them is dropping, I think it's a cash register. They're going to just, or something, they just get to drop it on their head.
That is it. I love that scene because Jack Black grabs a phone, smacks him in the head, teeth go flying out. Then they jump over the counter, start kicking him on the ground. And then Dick, of all people, grabs an air conditioner from the wall. He's holding it over his head. And then John Cusack's like, get him. That is my favorite, hands down, like scene in that movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such a great one. The shall we leave it at that? I think it's the line, I'd say my second favorite is not necessarily because it's the funniest, but just because it's the most different from all of that is the one where he is just like yelling at him, just like, you gotta get out of town.
Oh, yeah.
Being held back.
Being held back by them, yeah. He's like, you motherfucker, I'm gonna get you.
Yeah. It's just one where it's like, that one, actually, out of all of them, is the most obvious that it's not happening.
Yeah, I can see that.
That is the most out of character of Rob. That Rob being like, supremely confident in himself, and he just isn't. So like, whereas everything else is just, you know, him and his friend would absolutely pile on if
you would be right to kick off. Exactly, they would.
I will say one thing, I have absolutely no way of transitioning to this information, but I did find the full track listing for the Marie de Salle CD.
Oh, okay.
So in order on there, it's Baby I Love Your Way, Eartha Kitt Time 2, Ghostbusters, Beat It, Baby Got Back, 9/11 is a joke, or 911 is a joke.
911 is a joke, yeah.
I was gonna say 9/11 hadn't happened yet. No. So I was like,
911 is a Public joke. Enemy song.
Yeah, there you go. I Will Survive.
Okay.
Mbop. My Heart Will Go On. Yep. Mbop. Then My Heart Will Go On. You Can't Have It. And The Time Is Now. And just looking at that track listing and knowing that in the film, in the canon of this film, she has covered all of these songs. And it's just like Mbop and Mbop, Baby Got Back.
Baby Got Back.
Something for me, like, I do not have the ability to imagine something I haven't seen. Like, I can't do that. I can't, you know, it's one of the things where, like, you know how people will say, don't think of a pink elephant, and then that'll make you think of a pink elephant. It doesn't make me think of a pink elephant because I've never seen a pink elephant outside of Dumbo. So, like, I can't imagine an elephant and then make it pink in my head. So I can't actually imagine her singing something that I haven't heard her sing, but I genuinely cannot imagine that character at any point in time deciding to sing Mbop or Baby Got Back.
And what's fascinating about that is there are a couple times in the movie where they're playing the CD and I did not recall any of those songs being played. Now, keep in mind, she's supposed to be an acoustic singer playing with an acoustic guitar, or maybe even a cappella. I'm not 100% certain on that. So it
Yeah.
could just be very slowed down and stripped down. But yeah, that's weird. It's all covers, and it's weird covers on top of that. That is so interesting.
Yeah, quite literally all over the place. So there's no rhyme or reason to any of these. So I do think it would have been really funny to hear her version of, say, Ghostbusters or whatever. However,
right.
My assumption is, given all of the other songs that are in the film, they ran out of money to buy the license for those. So they probably just had the visual joke in there.
And I do want to say to anyone listening, if you've seen the movie or you're about to see the movie, all the songs that they mentioned, because they work in a record store or they're trying to sell records, they mentioned bands and they mentioned songs. Those are all real. Those are all real songs. You can get them on Spotify. Those are all real bands. I had a friend who was really into Belle and Sebastian. And like, I remember they were telling me, and I'm like, Belle and Sebastian, I've heard that before. And it was from this movie. And I was like, oh, that's a real band. Cause I thought, like, you know, they couldn't use real bands and real music because it costs too much. But then you think about it, these are all like indie artists. Like, they're all like somewhat underground, not very mainstream. The Beta Band's a real band. That song that they play is a real song. I've heard that out in the wild. I just heard that in a grocery store or something. I'm like, what the hell? That's weird. So yeah, all the non Lisa Bonet songs in the movie are real songs that you can actually get on Spotify. And this is a damn good soundtrack. This is one of the movies that I think has a wonderful soundtrack. I literally dig every song that pops up in this. You know, even the slow, sad bastard song that's at the beginning that Dick plays. I'm actually kind of into that song too. It might just be because I've seen this movie so many times.
Yeah.
But I can kind of get into it. So that great soundtrack to this.
Yeah. And one thing that they did, I found this out, and it does not surprise me at all, thinking about the film and everything that's in it, that the first song that Rob listened to in the film is You're Gonna Miss Me by 13 Floor Elevators. And the final song Rob listened to is I Believe by Stevie Wonder. And respectively, they are the opening and closing track of those albums that they're on.
That's cool. I did not look into all that, but that is really cool.
Yeah, and it's something that, like, absolutely makes sense.
Yeah,
you know, anyone that's seen the film will be like, of course. Like, of course that's what they did.
Of course.
Yeah, the only other thing in the film that is like a real sort of shock surprise that happens is the moment when he ends up in his head talking to Bruce Springsteen.
Oh yeah,
because yes. Why not? You know.
Yeah, hey, we gotta get the boss cameo in there.
Yeah, and I guess it was something that kind of just came together. This is me trying to remember something I read a little bit ago. So, I apologize if I have any of this wrong. But basically, they did want to have someone else initially, I think even potentially Bon Jovi. And they realized that wasn't going to work out for whatever reason. And they were just like, Bruce Springsteen, there's a thing, I think, in the book specifically where it mentioned, like, let's just ask him. And he ended up just initially, I think he said no. And then I think John Cusack reached out to him directly and kind of explained it. And he said, if it's going to be exactly like you said, I'll do it. And they went ahead and did it. And they just did it nice and fast. And I think they even like slightly rewrote the end of that scene because I guess and I do not know Bruce Springsteen song very well, not really my scene, but I guess the words that he says right at the end after Bruce Springsteen's last line is a line from a famous Bruce Springsteen song.
I'm not a huge Springsteen fan. Like, I know the big hits obviously, but like any of the deeper cuts, I don't really know. So that is totally possible. I know we're trying to wrap up. I just want to say one last thing, then we can probably wrap up.
Yeah.
This was like a passion project for John Cusack. He read this book and he wanted to make the movie, and I think he was trying to get it made for like a few years. Because if you read the credits, he's like super involved. He not
Yeah.
only stars in it, he wrote it or co-wrote it with like a bunch of other guys. He produced it. And like you said, he was really heavily involved in behind the scenes of trying to get this made. He moved this to Chicago because he's from him and Joan Cusack, they're from Chicago. And it's more of a city he's familiar with. And obviously he's not going to use a London accent. I don't think he wanted to even try it.
Yeah, I do not want to see that version of
Yeah.
the
So he just moved it to Chicago because he's more familiar with it. And I'm from Chicago, and a lot of the outside stuff was filmed on location, like the theater, the Biograph, where he says, oh, I had the name and I forget it. The gangster guy got shot behind. I can't think of his name. Not Al Capone, but another guy. Anyway,
film.
like that actually is like that. That's the actual theater. That's it. And a lot of the scenes on the L, I recognized the stations that he was at. I think the only thing that's not in Chicago was the outside of the record store. That might have been somewhere else because I did not recognize that. And the street that they showed, I don't recognize that street name. Otherwise, yeah, any other outside shots was filmed in Chicago. And yeah, he just wanted to get this made. It was his one of his favorite books. And I think too, there was like a deal like he was trying to get with the writer Nick Hornsby to try to get it, the rights to it or whatever. I think that there was something with that as well. But yeah, I'm glad he did it. I'm glad it's I honestly I cannot picture anyone else but John Cusack playing this role now. Which is funny, there was like a remake that came out in on Hulu.
Yeah, there was a TV
It was
show,
like they turned it into a TV show,
but it got
and
canceled after one season.
I had no interest in that. It just did not. I just had
Yeah.
no interest in.
I didn't even know that existed until I searched for High Fidelity on my streaming services, and I was like, oh, okay.
Oh no. Oh. But yeah, I didn't watch the show. I can't say if it's good or bad, but I just was like, no, I don't want to do that.
Yeah, I'm bother with it. Like, yeah,
I
I may
will.
have enjoyed the film, but I don't think the show would be my type.
Yeah, no. I will recommend the book, however. I think the book was good.
Okay.
It's a good companion piece. It gives you more deeper stuff into the characters. There is an extra scene in the book that gets set up in the movie. There's this part where he's taking a phone call and he says something like, "Yeah, I'm interested." And that's when Joan Cusack walks in and calls him an asshole. That scene gets followed up in the book where he's going to meet somebody to buy some records. And then there was like a point to it. I can't remember what.
Okay.
But anyway, my long-winded way of saying I love this movie. I love the book. John Cusack does an amazing job. Everyone does a great job with it. And I'm glad it got made.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I can. Yeah, I will say, again, sort of like thinking of it from the point of view that we're coming at it as in, does it hold up and would it get made today? I absolutely think that this film, for the most part, does hold up. There may be one or two words in the script that might not make it into the script today. I'm fairly certain that the R word is in there once. That I think just unless it was made today but set back then and it was in there as, that is the way that people spoke back then, but yeah, I think that this film could largely be made today, mostly unchanged, with the possible problem that if it was made today, a lot of the people going to see it would just be like, "What's a record store?"
What's Well, no, I don't know because vinyl is still pretty big.
It is.
I
However, I
think
think it's big for people aged, let's say, 30 and over,
I
and
don't know. Well, I'm only
most
gonna
people
just
under that, if they grew up with someone that has vinyl, would know what it is. But my daughter will have zero idea what Randall is. I do not own any. No one that she's around has any. We haven't talked about it. She will have no concept of what a vinyl is. Obviously, my daughter, who is 8, would not be going to see this film in the cinema. However, you know, she's not going to grow up in a household where vinyl is a thing. So I don't know if that's going to be something that's really going to be on her radar. And that is something that I found fascinating over the years. It's just like thinking of like, oh, there's this whole generation of people that, you know, you kind of mentioned before, you know, this magical place called a video store that you would go to and rent something. Yeah, it's like kids these days genuinely will. What's a video? Like, what do you mean, right? A video? Like, you went online and you clicked play? Like, no. You did not do that. No. I do think at some point I might try and do that thing where, you know, you find an old VHS and you just hand it to your kid and say, play this and see what they do.
Yeah, I'm only going to disagree with the vinyl thing because a lot of newer artists put their stuff on vinyl, most notably Taylor Swift. All of her new stuff is on vinyl, and she tends to have a younger audience.
True.
I think of maybe the idea of like a store for only vinyl may blow their minds because they're probably like, oh, let's just go to Target to get it, you know what I mean, or whatever.
Yeah,
you know, they don't, or order from Amazon, but they might not think to like, there were these actual stores that you walked into and it was just rows and rows of vinyl that you can get, and maybe some CDs depending on the, you know, how hipstery the place wanted to be, and you could just buy vinyl and CDs there, and you know, that mark may blow their mind, but they might, I think younger generation.
I think if it was made today, like there would need, if it was going to be a vinyl only store, or you know, something like that, there would need to be a reason why Rob is able to still have a just vinyl store in this day and age. Like maybe the actual owner of the building is like an uncle that like just doesn't charge him any rent, and he's just able to he's got 50 properties and he just lets him have the building just cause, like something like that, you know. I can't imagine someone like Rob clearly would not have the ability to manage a vinyl only store today. Like,
yeah, no, 100%.
Yeah, that would shutter in like 6 months.
I agree. And I think another thing that may confuse today's audience is actually the fact that they mentioned Virgin Megastore. because I use that line all the time when I get frustrated with something. I always say, one day I'm going to snap, throw the country A through K rack through the window and go work at a Virgin Megastore. And sometimes people have no idea what I'm talking about when I say that.
Yeah, I barely remember Virgin Megastore becoming a thing.
Okay.
Just before I left the UK, because in England, what would have been the equivalent of that, I believe, would have been a store called HMV, which I don't know if that came over here, but the logo of it is a dog looking at a an old school gramophone.
Oh, okay. Thing.
The idea being that he's listening to his master's voice on it, the HMV.
Got it.
And that was a store that sold CDs, vinyls, and then also DVDs, weirdly. I never saw any VHSs there, but I did see DVDs.
Okay.
That actually was complete side tangent. That was where I would go and get some anime. That I got into, like the entirety of Ghost in the Shell, the TV series, as well as sort of an introduction to Bleach, Naruto, and One Piece. I am now kicking myself that I completely ignored One Piece because I looked at it and went, "Oh, that looks too kiddie." So I never actually got into that show. But like, God damn it, 1,000 plus episodes now, and I want to start that show so badly.
Man. Oh, man.
But yeah, I might wait for that. They're coming out. I think Netflix is doing it. They're coming out with a new One Piece cartoon that is effectively Dragon Ball Z abridged, but for One Piece. Well,
they made that a live action show, didn't they?
They did. It's amazing. Okay. And they're gonna do it again, but they changed enough from it. For instance, not that this is a live action One Piece podcast right now, but there is something that is revealed at the end of the third episode of that show that is not revealed for, I think, over 100 episodes of the anime.
Oh, man.
That,
okay.
Yeah, it's something like there's at least one arc, if not two arcs, before this piece of information is revealed in the anime. And they just gave it away.
Show.
And it makes sense in the show. It absolutely makes sense in the show. I saw online a lot of people just being like, oh, okay. we're doing this now. If you ever wanted to get into One Piece, but you not want to jump into, again, 1,000 plus episodes of the show, the live action is phenomenally done. Oda is actually connected with the show directly, and he's kind of got final say on the show. Everything that's in it has his stamp of approval. And the guy that plays Luffy is absolutely perfect, like spot on. You could not have got a better Luffy. Again, we're getting back to wrapping up. I do think this film, like, kind of, you know, assuming that we're saying it was made today but set back then, because it's very much a product of its time, just because of the subject matter, because of what's in it, it kind of makes sense that it would be set then, even if it was made now. Like, some of the stuff in it really holds up. Like we mentioned, the fact that the one girlfriend has a genuine discussion about, like, hey, the stuff that happened, wasn't rape, but have been, like, that right, sort of right, stuff. Right. The character of Marie DeSalle being just this 100% confident, like, sex positive, like, just like,
yeah,
I just want to have sex. You wanna? Okay. Yeah. Like, yeah. And it's not treated as, this woman's a slut over here. Right. She wants to have sex. Like, no, it's like, she wants to have sex. You want to have sex? Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's how it's treated. Like, and exactly. It's something that, and it's because, probably because that's not the point of the film. The point of the film is Robin, the journey that he's going through, to realize how shitty a person he is. But, the fact that they just kind of like, yeah, okay. And it's like that with a lot of the characters. Like, one final question for you. Who is the worst character in the film?
I'm going to go Ian.
You're going to say Ian?
I'm going to say Ian was the worst, because he came off as a real pretentious, pompous douchebag.
Mm-hmm.
I liked his, like Rob's description of him as he discovers, that's who she's been seeing now. And, the smell of patchouli, awful cooking smells, all this stuff about him. And you see him, when you see him, you're like, you picture all that. And you're like, yeah, this checks. I think he is probably.
All right. I would be willing to argue that the general sort of feeling towards him is heavily influenced by what Rob's saying, and the fact that, like, he's a protagonist, so, like, we sort of put this on him. I honestly don't think anything that Ian does in the film necessarily actually portrays him as a bad person or like anything like that. It's just that we're not supposed to like him because he's the thing that's in the way. I don't necessarily want to sit and have a conversation with the guy, but that's not anything against him. Personally, I think the worst character, as in, like, genuine character of the character in the entire film is, without a doubt, Charlie. She absolutely stuck up, pretentious, you know, that is kind of the thing that Rob comes to understand is that, oh, she's awful.
Yeah.
Like she, and she, I guess she's always been awful and like very just rapid and believing she's better than everyone else and all this stuff. So it's like, yeah, wow. And, you know, it played perfectly by Catherine Zeta-Jones. And like you, yeah, initially when it's just Rob looking back on it, she very much is just, you know, oh, she was just nice one that, you know, effectively it was, like, if you really think about it, it was, oh, she looked nice and seemed like she was always up for having sex, and that's really all he seemed to want. But he felt that he couldn't keep up with her at the time, and then she just moved on. And if you go back on it, it's like, oh yeah, she, there's really nothing there. Like that, that is who she was as a person, because she just is that shallow. And just it's like, I'll just do this and now I'm bored. Like, yeah, it's genuinely a worse person than Rob. Yeah, well done. You take that ground. But as I think both of us have said throughout this, like, you know, genuinely a good film. You know, I was surprised at how well it did hold up, and you know, how well it handled some of the characters and some of the beats. There's definitely the cheesy bits in there, and there's a couple of moments where it's like, this is late 90s, early 2000s era. Like, you can absolutely tell, especially the way that, yeah, some of the incidental characters are, the two skateboarders that are in the band. You see them, you're like, oh, like, they may as well be standing in the background of the party at the beginning of American Pie. That's just who they are as people, and there's just extra brought in for that. But you know, that again, there's only so much you can expect from these films from back then. I heartily recommend this to anyone that, you know, anyone listening to this that hasn't seen it at this point, I'm sorry. You know, we've clearly spoiled a whole bunch, but you know, go and see it anyway, because there's so much in it that you'll get out of it. And that
there's a lot we didn't talk about that I think you might find interesting. So yeah, go check it out. It's a good movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you mentioned at the end, you know, we get Jack Black's character, you know, playing, singing the song at the end. I did find out that apparently when this film premiered, they then had like an after party at a venue that Tenacious D played at. That kind of makes sense, because I guess Tenacious D was formed in 1994.
Yeah, they've been around for a very long time. Yeah.
So yeah, they already existed as a band when Jack Black made this film. And so they were just like, I'm kind of shocked that Kyle Gass is not somewhere in the background of this film. Like, yeah, maybe in the background at the funeral. You know, it's just like, yeah, not even saying anything, but just being there. It's kind of odd that he wasn't there. But whatever.
I don't think Jack Black had that kind of pull back then to pull that off. Like, he could probably do that now, but I think back in 2000, yeah, I don't think he could be like try to convince John Cusack to put his buddy in the background. I don't think he had that kind of pull.
Maybe not, but apparently again, something that I had written down, wouldn't you rather bring it up? The director of the film was the person that said, like, Jack Black needs to play Barry. Like, and Jack Black even initially turned it down, but the director was like, no, you need to play Barry. It's something that I think potentially if he had gone, hey, can Carl be in here? They might have done it. But I can't really think of anything I would change outside of just like the odd tweak here and the pacing that I mentioned previously. But really, no, I would say this definitely holds up. All right. And with that, I believe we have talked about this almost as long as the film's runtime itself. So So with that, we may as well wrap it on up. So why don't you let people know where they can find you and, you know, by extension, Rabbit Hole Podcast and so on.
Yeah, so I have a podcast network. It is called Rabbit Hole Podcast, and we have a lot of different shows. Not all of them are hosted by me. They are hosted by other wonderful people. I've also bought on older shows that, you know, were on their own. They wanted to join a network. They came and joined us. Paul, and this show you're listening to is one of those who wanted to join a wonderful network. Mm-hmm. So you can go check out all of those at rabbitholepodcasts.com. That is probably the best place that you can go find every show that we do, every episode that we have done of every show, and a lot of cool stuff there. Whatever you may be into, whether it's movies, music, books, TV shows, literally we cover it all. There's all kinds of great stuff there. So rabbitholepodcast.com, that is where you can check all of that out.
Yeah, and I can't believe you didn't specifically mention the podcast talking exclusively about famous people who have died. I mean, come on, why is
that? Yeah, there's so much. There's literally a podcast for almost anything there. Yeah, people, celebrities who've died. We got a comedy show. We got deep dives into 90s TV shows. There's a lot of stuff going.
Yeah, absolutely. Go check that out. After you've re-listened to this episode 20 times,
yes.
And, you know, featured it on your own top five list of podcasts. Once again, thank you for coming on. Been a absolute pleasure having you on here. If you did want to reach out to me personally about this episode or anything else, or even suggestions for other episodes, you can find Blokebusters pretty much anywhere you would expect to find Blokebusters. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter /X, however you want to identify that particular one. Feel free to reach out there. You can email the blokes at blokebusters.com if you want. You can go to blokebusters.com. You can't contact us there, but I have a website. It's fun. Yay, go have a look. I really do need to update that one, but go check it out. Come say hi. It's always interested in talking with people about film and pretty much anything, as you've heard over the course of this podcast. So with all that being said, I've been Paul, and he's been Jason, and we'll see you next time. Bye.
In case I don't see you, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
Hang on a minute, lads. I've got a great idea.
Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.